Okay, my screen is showing 9 p.m. I know when we met 2 weeks ago, there were some people who had some problems receiving me. That is, you heard the voice maybe, but my face was frozen. Please, you can contact tech support if there is a problem, but hopefully everything will work. This might be our last session on the Chatam Sofer, or perhaps not, maybe one more after this. As I mentioned last time, I want to go through some things today with the Chatam Sofer's philosophy, views of Kabbalah, Chassidut. He had a big argument in certain areas with Chassidut. And then there's some halachic issues, mitzitza bepeh, and other things that we need to get to. And I'll conclude with some interesting memoir, an interesting memoir that deals with him. So let us begin. If you recall, 2 weeks ago, when we last met, I was speaking about natural law. That is, that things are basically not known through nature. And that's where we'll pick up now. The Chasam Sofer, and there's been a lot written about natural law. For the most part, I think the medieval philosophers accepted the idea that there is a natural law. The Chasam Sofer, however, says that if you refrain from murder and adultery, not because it's inherently destructive. That is, you do refrain from them, not because they're destructive, but because of God's command. And if you follow these seemingly natural laws for any other reason, then you're worshiping other, quote, gods. And he also says that the mitzvot sichliot, these are all mitzvot sichliot, that is, things that you can understand through your mind, you must perform them only because of God's command. So we need to understand, what's he talking about here? Obviously, even without a divine command, you know that it's forbidden to steal and to kill. What he's saying is very similar, maybe identical even, to a position laid out years ago by Marvin Fox, that now, yes, you could have known these things without a Torah. You could have learned, let's say, certain behaviors from the animals. But now that we have a Torah, although it is rational, these commands you could say are rational and that we can know them otherwise, now that they've been given, we do them precisely because of the command, that's the motivating factor. And when you think of it, it is a little strange. In the late 1960s, Commentary had a symposium. They did a second symposium about 10 years ago. But the first symposium is a very good symposium. The second one wasn't so good. And you had all sorts of thinkers from the different movements in Judaism. And then you had for some reason, they asked Rabbi Moshe Tendler, who's really not a thinker. He's a scientist and a halachist, but he wrote in it, and he said, just matter-of-factly, that we give tzedakah because it was commanded to give tzedakah. And I remember when I read it, thinking that none of the philosophically inclined would say that, because this is very much of a divine command sort of way of looking at matters. But that's what the Chasam Sofer says. He further says, if you look at the mitzvot that you do as a means to connect to God, I mean, this is a common understanding that we do the mitzvot, or we do them so that we can connect to God. I think plenty of sermons say this exact thing, that we do the mitzvot as this enables us to connect to God. He says, even this praiseworthy goal taints your intention and is not to be regarded as selfless, but as almanach l'kabal pras. We'll see that the Yeshaya Leibovitz, if we ever get to Yeshaya Leibovitz, he says the exact same thing. He doesn't quote the Chasam Sofer, but the Chasam Sofer says that he doesn't deny that you get close to God through doing the mitzvah. But this comes by itself. It's part of the mitzvah by definition of being close to God. But if your intention in doing the mitzvah is to get close to God, then you are, to use the Yishai Revitz's expression, you're serving yourself. You're not serving God. Service of God is supposed to be selfless. And the connection here, the parallelism between Leibovitz, the radical, I would definitely term him radical, late 20th century thinker, and the Chasam Sofer is quite amazing. Now, we will come back to Yishai Revitz when we deal with the Or Sameach. because, as we'll see, for some of Leibovitz's what I would call strange ideas, the one source that he could find was the Or Sameach, was Rav Meir Simcha, actually not the Or Sameach, but in the Meshech Chachma. But we call Rav Meir Simcha the Or Sameach. The Chasam Sofer even says that you are supposed to rejoice that you can rejoice that you can study the Torah. However, the study of Torah itself should not be a cause for pleasure. You should not get joy out of the study of your Torah. You should only have joy that you have the ability to study Torah. But the study of Torah itself should not give you joy. Rather, the emotion should be one of awe. The sense of standing, you know, awe. I don't need to translate awe. I think this should be contrasted with the introduction of the Sechel Shaver to the Eglei Tal, when it's a very interesting thing he dealt with. Some people feel, or at least people felt, or he was confronted with the problem. People asked him, perhaps, that let's say when you learn Torah, you get joy out of it. Exactly what the Chasam Sofer says, that's not, you should not feel this in the best of all circumstances. I guess, and perhaps it's impossible not to feel joy, but that should not, this is not something you should want to feel. But what about people who study Torah because they enjoy it? I mean, there's plenty of people who, if you ask them honestly why they're studying Torah, they'll tell you they study it because they love it. They enjoy it for whatever reason. Either they intellectually they love it, or it enables them to connect to God. So the Sechel Shaver's question was, does this take away from the study of Torah? Because you're not now studying Torah because it's a command, but you're studying it because you get enjoyment out of it. I remember when, years ago, I was still living in Scranton, and I spoke to someone, and I use this example often to show anti-intellectualism in Orthodoxy. On the one hand, how could you have anti-intellectualism in ultra-Orthodoxy, a Haredi society, because those people study Torah all the time. I mean, you're studying Torah, even for the Haredim who have a job, they'll still study, they'll be Koveya Itim LaTorah, much more than the modern Orthodox. It'll be 2-3 hours a day. I'll get to your question in a minute, Shlomo. But he said something to me, this person I was talking about, which really amazed me. He said that, I study Torah because it's a commandment, it's a mitzvah. If it wasn't a mitzvah, you think I'd be studying Torah? In other words, the study of Torah was a form learning. It was a form of ritual. Just like you keep Shabbos and Kashrus, you study Torah. And he couldn't understand that if it wasn't a mitzvah, a command, he would never do it. That to me is the ultimate in anti-intellectualism. The idea that just like you'd say the only reason you do a commandment is because you're commanded to. The only reason, as opposed to seeing the value in and of itself, which most people always think is a positive, to say that you only study Torah because it's a commandment, and that if all of a sudden I told you it's not a commandment, you'd have no connection to it. Real intellectuals, they need the books. They need to study it. And I saw it up close, living in that community, incidentally, that the real intellectuals are the ones that if you have any conversation with and you point out, you know, that there's some interesting, let's say, tshuva, the note of Yehuda, they'll want to know. They'll say, oh, show it to me. You know, they need to see that. But the ones who are just studying Torah because it's a commandment, they have no intellectual curiosity. And if you mention that interesting tshuva, the note of Yehuda, they would never ask you, well, can I see it? Because basically they're not really interested in knowing the note of Yehuda. They're not interested in knowledge. They're interested simply in fulfilling the mitzvah, so they can learn whatever Gemara they want to learn, and they fulfill the same thing. Now, Shlomo asks, we pray that the Torah should be sweet. I don't think the Chasam Sofer is saying it shouldn't be sweet, but the point is that, and he's also not saying that, actually he is saying, he says that it shouldn't be a cause of pleasure. What is sweet? I don't know if sweet is the same as pleasure. He's saying that your feelings when you study Torah should be a feeling of awe. That it should not be a feeling of pleasure studying it. Or else you're not studying it for the proper purposes. It's a good question about, we pray that Torah should be sweet. Is that referring to the study of Torah? Or is that referring to the Torah life? And it could be sweet even if it's an awe. And that Yisrael points out, I say this for those who are listening, who won't be watching us, that it's, he's not saying it shouldn't be sweet, but the feeling should be awe. Yeah, I don't know if awe and sweetness contradict each other. But when you're studying an aspect of the Torah, what is your emotion? Is your emotion a feeling of joy that you're learning Torah, or a feeling of awe that you're in the presence of God? We're going to see. We'll come back to this or something similar in a few minutes. And in any event, I don't know how consistent the Chasam Sofer is on all these areas. This was a debate that I had in Chakira with Nussan David Rabinovich. He wrote an article, a long article. Mostly it was attacking the late Aaron Schreiber's article in Chakira on the Chasam Sofer and Secular Studies. And the last few pages he goes after me because he sees, I had said in an article I wrote that in a couple areas the Chasam Sofer is inconsistent. And he thought that was a negative. That great figures are not supposed to be inconsistent, so he tries to show that there really is an inconsistency. And in my response, which was a very short response, because I think anyone can look at my piece and his piece and draw your own conclusions, I quote Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who says that, basically says that only simpletons think that it's a positive thing when you say that someone is completely settled in all his opinions, but people who understand greatness know that to be complicated, to be complex, that's what all great people are, and that their ideas are not always in line with one another. Just look at the Rambam to give you one example. But all our great authorities have times when they contradict. And that's for a few different reasons. It could be because when Rabbi Soloveitchik is famous for contradicting himself, and I think the reasons given are two. One, when every time he learned the sugya anew, he came up with different insights. And second of all, and we have many examples from our Soloveitchik practical halakha, different opinions, that's because depending on who's asking him, he'll give a different answer. But in terms of learning, when you learn a sugya a second or third or fourth time, you often see different sides to the issue and you come up with different opinions. And I've already mentioned how the Chasam Sofer was opposed, forcefully opposed, to the study of Tamei HaMitzvot. And yet, there are places where he says just the opposite, where he says that antinomianism, remember, the reason why he opposed the study of mitzvot was because he thought it would lead to antinomianism. He says that that only applies when you're performing the mitzvah. That is, when I'm doing the mitzvah, I can't think about the reason, because that will lead to antinomianism. However, at other times, there's no problem plumbing the depths of the commandments. And he says that the tzaddikim do try to get to the bottom of the commandments. Now, I don't know. I see this as a great conflict within him, that on the one hand he speaks about, and he doesn't make this distinction. He just says that Tamei HaMitzvah is not something we should be concerned with. Instead, we do the mitzvah because we're commanded. And elsewhere, he writes about how it's only when you're performing the mitzvah that you do not look for the commandment. I see this, and again, like I said, Rabinovitz disagreed, although his reading of the Chasam Sofer doesn't make any sense to me. And you can see my response. I think it actually contradicts what the Chasam Sofer says. All I would say is that I think that the Chasam Sofer struggled with this issue and didn't arrive at a consistent solution. And we've seen and will continue to see many examples of authorities who seem to go back and forth. The Chasam Sofer rejects philosophy. That there's no doubt about. He mentions the Chovos Lovavos, he mentions the Rambam at times, and he's not a fan of philosophy. And he's able to point out correctly that philosophy has changed so much since the Rambam's day that it shows that the Chasam Sofer's problem with the Rambam is the same problem that everyone had, that he was so committed to an Aristotelian outlook that when Aristotelianism is a thing of the past, what are you left with? You're left with crude attempts to put the Torah in an Aristotelian box, and when no one accepts Aristotelianism anymore, where does that leave you? Therefore, he says, philosophy, which is based on transitory ideas, is not something that the Jewish people should be focused on. Rather, we focus on the Torah. However, unlike other authorities, he doesn't discount philosophy entirely, which I think is interesting. he sees it as valuable for the non-Jews. And he even writes that in our day and age, the non-Jews are spreading knowledge. He writes this in 1794. The non-Jews are spreading knowledge of philosophy, and they even recognize God through philosophy. However, the Jewish people, he says, who are a wise and understanding nation, we don't need this philosophy. Because at the end of the day, the philosophy is transitory. So it's good for the Gentiles that today philosophy is valuable for them, and they're able, it leads them to a recognition of God. Very soon that would change when the philosophy was used to disprove God's existence. But the Chasam Sofer's point is that we don't need philosophy, that is Jews, because we have the eternal truth. The non-Jews who don't have that eternal truth, philosophy, if it's helpful to them, then it's helpful. The one exception to his rule, that is that one shouldn't study philosophy, is certain people, and we're talking about the elites here, not the masses, are permitted to study philosophy in order to know how to answer the heretics. But as you can expect, he says that philosophy must be a secondary pursuit. He quotes the letter of the Rambam. This is a famous letter of the Rambam. The Rambam, in writing to the scholars of France, says that although he studies all the sciences, these sciences are only like handmaidens. They're not essential. They're secondary. What do you make of this letter? Because if you look in Yesodei HaTorah, at the beginning of the Mishnah Torah, physics and metaphysics, which are science, these are put right at the beginning. This is the essence of Torah. So Professor Tursky thought that the Rambam must have been referring to cognates, such as mathematics, that these are what he regards as secondary things that he doesn't spend so much time on. Others have, because physics and metaphysics, and when I say physics, chemistry, etc., that's part of Gufei Torah. Others think that, and I'm more inclined to this opinion, that in writing to the scholars of northern France, ones who had no exposure to philosophy, the Rambam tilts his argument in a certain way. That is, he writes for his audience. Chasam Sofer, he uses the expression rakachot v'tavachot that the Rambam uses and says that philosophy, even for those who study it, needs to be made central. Now, needs to be made secondary. Now, this rejection of philosophy leads to a fascinating understanding of Avraham's realization that there's a supreme God. I mean, if you look at the Avraham story, Avraham was a bit of a philosopher. He looks around, he examines the universe, and he concludes that there is a God. And if you look at the Agadah, he's actually a very young person when he discovers that there's a ruler for the universe. And throughout Jewish history, this independent recognition was regarded as a great merit for Avraham. That is, Avraham on his own was able to conclude that there is a God, and there's all sorts of discussions in which Avraham is put on a pedestal because he was able to come to this knowledge. And precisely because of this, many explain, this was why God chose him. And this is the biggest question. If you look, Perek Yud Beis, I think it is. The Perek begins, God says to Abraham, leave this land. And his name is Abram then. Abram has just arrived on the scene. We know nothing about him. All we have is in the previous chapter, if I'm not mistaken, the end of chapter 11, where it talks about that he and his family moved a bit. And the first thing we know of is God speaking to him. So we have no knowledge. And anyone who looks at this chapter, the first question they have to ask is, well, maybe the second question. The first question might be, why is God telling him to get out? What's wrong with where he is at present? And the second question therefore has to be, though, why Abram? Here we have God says, get out, and he's going to make him the progenitor of this new nation. Why? Why Abraham? What did Abraham do? And obviously the Agadah explains this. That is, Abraham was able on his own to come to the knowledge of God. And after we read all the various Agadot that fill in the blanks, the story, before we get to Perek Yud Beis, Abraham's youth in his homeland, the relationship with his father, Terach, etc., Now it makes sense. Now the blessings that God gives Abraham are not gratuitous, so we understand. In line with this understanding, that is, the understanding that it's because that God, that Abraham on his own comes to a recognition of God, that's why God blesses him and makes him the founder of this new nation. The Rambam in the Mishnah Torah gives his age at 40. Because if you look at the Agadah, or at least the famous Agadah, Abraham is 3 years old. From the Rambam's perspective, this doesn't make any sense. No three-year-old is going to be able to discover God. There's other versions, incidentally, of Agadah, different ages, but that's a famous one. So, and it was Rabbi Yechiel of Weinberg who pointed out that it's precisely because of the Rambam's rationalism. He could not accept the notion that someone 3 years old could have discovered God on his own. Therefore, he picked 40. And why did he pick 40? Where does 40 come from? It could be that he had a different version of the Midrash that says Avraham was 40. Because as I mentioned, there are different versions of Avraham's age. None of the ones that survive give Avraham's age at 40. But maybe, you know, the Rambam had access to different texts that we don't have. Or it could be that if you remember in Avos, when does, quote, understanding come? How old are you? 40. That's when, according to Mishnah Avos, chapter 5, it tells us that understanding comes. So if the Rambam, in trying to speak about the history, wants to tell us when Avraham came to this understanding, it makes sense if he pick a number 40. I don't think that the Rambam actually means it literally 40, but he's picking a number, like an archetypal number, that that you can say that most people, if they're going to get understanding, that's the age. That's when the Rambam picks it. But however you look at it, the Rambam and the rest of the interpretations, Avraham independently arrives at the existence of God, arrives at monotheism. However, the Chasam Sofer has a different perspective on this matter. He calls attention to a midrash in Bereishit Rabbah. Those who want to check it, it's Lamed Tet 39. Commenting on the passage that I just referred to, actually I see now from my notes, it is Parak Yud Beis. When God says to Avraham, get out of the country, Rav Yitzhak says that this is comparable to a man who is traveling from place to place and he sees a building and the building is in flames. And he asks himself, is it possible that this is a building? It must have been built by someone. Is it possible that there's no one to look after it? And then the owner of the building comes onto the scene and says, yes, I'm the owner of the building. The Midrash continues. Similarly, Avraham said, is it conceivable that the world is without a guide? And God then looks out and says to him, I am the guide, sovereign of the universe. In other words, according to this Midrash, and this is what the Chasam Sofer picks up on, Avraham never actually concludes authoritatively, definitively, that there is a God controlling the universe. Rather, all he was able to conclude was, or to come to the assumption, that how could you have a universe without a God? But it was necessary for God to reveal himself for him to actually conclude. That is, there has to be a guide for the universe. Well, this could be, as David Hume pointed out, maybe our world is the product of two other worlds that, and one world gives birth to this world. It could have been Satan ruling this world. All Avraham concluded was that there must be someone in charge of this. Maybe the sun is in charge of our world. So Avraham was able to get beyond that initial stage. He recognized that there needs to be a guide for the world, but that it's a one God, that he recognizes that there must be a monotheism here, like other Midrashim talk about, that he on his own concluded this. No, for that, Hashem has to come out and say, no, I am the ruler of this world. And this, the lesson of this Midrash is very much in line with the Chasam Sofer's own dominant approach. Even Avraham Avinu was not able independently to arrive at proper conclusions about God. Because as the Chasam Sofer puts it, human intellect cannot arrive at these things. It needs divine assistance, which means that philosophy, even when carried out by someone as great as Avraham, cannot arrive at the divine truths independently, as the Rambam thought. Rather, it can only ask the questions, or it can only disprove the falsehoods, but it also needs the divine assistance to get to the final stage and actually reach conclusions. And what's the divine assistance? For us, it's the Torah. And therefore, Chasam Sofer concludes in this passage that the children of Abraham do not need philosophy. He terms philosophy mechkar. Today, Mehkar means something different. It means academic studies or something like that. But that's the term that the Chasam Sofer uses. But rather, we accept these truths based on tradition that's been passed down through the generations. Sometimes I wonder if the Chasam Sofer would be against the whole Kirov Eishet Torah trying to prove religion and all this, because maybe for Kirov it's okay, but fundamentally we don't do that, he's saying. That we can't prove these things. By definition, we can't prove God or anything else. Rather, we have a Torah, and we accept it on faith. Although philosophy is therefore excluded from the Chasam Sofer's curriculum, Kabbalah is an integral part of it. I'll say it again. The Chasam Sofer believes that Kabbalah is basic for scholars, not for the masses. He was also a complete believer in practical Kabbalah. He said that he saw how Rav Nosson Adler would actually use holy names, Kamehas, and that they had an effect. They worked. I'll show you something now. I'll explain what's coming up in a minute. The Chasam Sofer would himself sometimes give out Kamehot. I don't know if these were original to him, or if he just used the Kamehot he copied from Rav Nosson Adler. Here is an example of a Kameya. I'll make it a little larger even. This comes, as it says at the bottom here, you can see it. This is a Kameya from Rav Nosson Adler, copied from the Chasam Sofer. This is the Chasam Sofer's handwriting. So here's a Kameya. He says at the top, Kivalti Mimori, I received from my teacher. This is not something the Rambam would do. The Rambam didn't believe in any of these Kamehas. So when I tell you that the Chasam Sofer, like his teacher, Nosson Adler, would give out amulets, and this book that this comes from has other examples of amulets of both of them, you see that he's not a Lithuanian Torah scholar. Lithuanian Torah scholars didn't do amulets or anything like that. In fact, if you look at Chut HaMashuash, it talks about how a boy in town was possessed by a dibbuk, and that they used an amulet of the Chasam Sofer to force the dibbuk out of the boy. So the Chasam Sofer is not a rationalist. I just have to stress that, because sometimes people will speak of him as sort of like a rationalist. Like they speak about the Vilna Gaon, if you can believe it. People talk of the Vilna Gaon as a rationalist, because they know he's nothing could be further from the truth. Both the Vilna Gaon and the Chasam Sofer, although most of their time was spent on Talmud and Halakha, this did not mean that they did not have any involvement in Kabbalah. We're not dealing with a 19th century Lithuanian Torah scholar. And even in Lithuania, this is only a short period, really, where they didn't have involvement with Kabbalah. Rav Chaim Volozhiner knew Kabbalah was involved. So it's fine, in the mid-19th century, I guess even into our own time, maybe, the prototypical Lithuanian Torah scholar has no involvement in Kabbalah. But that wasn't the case in Hungary, and it wasn't the case for the Chasam Sofer. And this attachment to Kabbalah shouldn't surprise us. It can't surprise us. Because who were his great teachers? We already know. Rav Pinchas Horowitz and Rav Nosson Adler. Both of whom were accomplished Mekubalim, and Rav Nosson Adler's life, to a large extent, revolved around Kabbalah. A good portion of the Chasam Sofer's writings deal with Kabbalistic themes. Yes, you can point to various assertions, I think three or four times in his Tshuvot, where he's dealing with halachic matter, and there's a Zohar on it, or there's a Kabbalistic idea, which seems to go against the standard halachic approach. The Chasam Sofer will say, quote, "Ein li yesek b'nistarot," or something similar. But these are either typical rabbinic protestations of modesty that, he's not a great Kabbalist, or it simply means, and this is what I think it usually means, that in halachic matters, in particular when the normative halachic tradition is challenged by positions advocated by Kabbalistic texts, Kabbalistic considerations are not authoritative. And this is the standard position. The Radbaz says the same thing. And the Radbaz wrote a whole Kabbalistic book, Mitzvot HaStavim. He's a big Mekubal. But if you have the halacha, let's say the rabbis don't quote the Shulchan Aruch, but subsequently, if you have a halacha in the Shulchan Aruch and you have a halacha, let's say the Ari says to do something, most authorities hold that you do the Shulchan Aruch, you do the nigla, you don't do what the Ari says. It is true that in later years you do have certain people who say that the Ari can trump the Shulchan Aruch, but that is not the mainstream position. So how do we understand the Chasam Sofer? There's a difference between private study of Kabbalah for the elites, for the intellectuals, versus public study. And this is a theme found in so many. Really, until modern times, and I think even today, the mainstream Kabbalists believe that Kabbalah is something for elites, and, for elites, not for the masses. Today we have the Kabbalah Center, we have even people other than the Kabbalah Center, Breslov and others, who think that in our generation, Kabbalah needs to be spread to the masses. And you did have certain, there were occasionally Kabbalists who thought that Kabbalah is something that the masses, at least certain aspects of it, could be initiated into. I guess Hasidut is a certain form of Kabbalah. Maybe Hasidut, I think you could say, is Kabbalah for the masses. Maybe that's fair to say. It's not Kabbalah in the sense that you're reading Cordovero or the Ari, but it's a sort of Kabbalah. But the Chasam Sofer distinguishes, as I said, between, as his teachers did, between the masses and the elites, and also between individual practices of the elites, that is, the Ari. And the Hafla had certain Kabbalistic practices on their own, including various tikkunim and various things they did, they said, which they did not institute for the masses. Now, the Hafla, this is just himself. Rav Nosson Adler, although the Chasam Sofer in his tshuva says that both Rav Nosson Adler and the Hafla never brought their ideas to other people, what I think he means is in Voskovit and for the masses, because in the Rav Nosson Adler's private minion, the people did adopt Kabbalistic practices, but still, this is an elite group of people. But you do not impose, and you not even impose, you don't spread these practices on the community. And that's, we see this, it's found among many Mekubalim. And years ago, when Rabbi Soloveitchik's Machzor came out, I made a critical comment about his Machzor, which the author of it, I see Bill is on, if I'm not mistaken, Arnie Lustiger lives in, maybe in your community, I don't, in Jersey, Highland Park, that area. What was my criticism? My criticism was really derived on this tradition of Kabbalah, but I applied it to Rabbi Soloveitchik. If you read this Machzor, every time that Rabbi Soloveitchik had an unusual practice, he mentions it. And I said that fine, if you want to mention it the first time or mention it at the beginning, explain it. But when you put it in the Machzor itself, and every time, and this is a Machzor that people, this is not a Machzor for study, this is a Machzor people use, this is telling people this is what the Rav did, and I think the subtext is you do this too because the Rav did it. When truthfully, the Rav never brought these practices, and I confirm this by calling people in Boston, speaking to one of the Gabbayim there, to Maimonides' minion. All of these practices, which are now being put in this book so that everyone can see, and I look around, people do them now. In Maimonides' minion, the Rav never mentioned them publicly and never even recommended for people to do these sorts of practices. And this was a minion of his chassidim, if I can use that term. So it's the same sort of thing with the Chasam Sofer. So much so that there was a Machzor published in 1811, and the Chasam Sofer has a Haskamah to it, and he insists in his Haskamah that no Kabbalistic prayers should appear in this Machzor. We're going to see this theme over and over again. Well, God willing, we'll get to the Note of Yehuda, and we'll see his famous Tshuva on Lashem Yichud. The Chasam Sofer also deals with it. The Chavos Yara deals with it. Art Scroll Siddur now has the Lashem Yichuds in it. And I think that's probably a good idea because some people do say Lashem Yichud. But the Chasam Sofer did not believe in putting these things in. And Rabbi Yehuda says you don't say these things. That he's speaking to the masses, though. The elites. There's nothing wrong with an elite saying it. If an elite... What do I mean by an elite? I mean, if someone who studies Kabbalah and understands what Lashem Yichud means and all these and all the secrets, he can say it. But you're going to give the ignorant person, the masses, you're going to have them recite the Lashem Yichud? I mean, this it makes no sense. Someone's writing. Okay. This is the tradition that became mainstream in the non-Hasidic world, that the value of Kabbalah is recognized, the holiness of Kabbalah is recognized, but it's not to move out of its bounds. So Bill asks, does the exclusivity of Kabbalah for the elites have a parallel in other religious cultures? Yeah, definitely. Take Hinduism, for example. Do you know that in Hinduism, first of all, the untouchables can't study. They're not even allowed to be given insights into the Vedas. And what you do is you have to go, you study with a master, and no women are allowed either. And only people in the upper castes are allowed insights into the Upanishads. You have this in Christianity. You have it in, I assume you have it in Islam too, but the idea that there's certain, only certain people can be exposed to it. Cardinal Newman, not just Cardinal Newman, let me go back, Augustine. Augustine even speaks about this, the idea that certain ideas are not for the masses. So I think this is basic to all religious traditions, because look, with the ignorant masses, the most important thing with the ignorant masses is you want to keep them still worshiping. And you can't, certain things are dangerous. But it's not just religion. This is basic to the philosophers also, that this is Hermann Strauss, Leo Strauss's The Persecution and the Art of Writing, that is, that philosophers also wrote in an esoteric fashion because the masses couldn't be expected to understand certain things. And when you deal with Kabbalah, I mean, what, you're going to start bringing the masses into ideas like the Sefirot, God has 10 aspects, and all these sorts of things? This is not something that the masses can be expected to understand. Celibacy. I'm not sure what Shlomo says celibacy. I'm not sure what Shlomo means by celibacy, unless you're implying Christianity, that the celibacy is for the elites. Perhaps, yeah, Chabad. Well, I mean, Chabad is an elite group itself, although it's become, I mean, now they try to teach this sort of thing for everyone. They translate into English, but let's not forget that Chabad prided itself as being an elitist movement among the Hasidim, that they were the most intellectual of the group. Now, Bill says most of the Rav's Minhagim were from the Gaon. I that's what they say, although there are some of them where the Rav on his own concludes. For example, you see quoted there that he thinks that a certain formulation of Machzor is incorrect, that sort of thing. And then you have practices which I don't know who they're from. For example, the idea that you stand throughout the entire repetition of the Shemon Esrei. I never heard that as from the Gaon. I don't know if that's from Rav Chaim or maybe from Moshe, or maybe it's independent to the Rav. But you'll find people, followers of the Rav, they stand throughout the entire repetition of the Shemon Esrei. As I don't, like I said, I don't know where that. They think it's a Kiyum and Tefillah. Fine, but I mean, I've never heard that the Rav thought that this was something that the masses should adopt. It makes it difficult, you know. Sometimes you're with these people and you want to walk out, let's say for some reason during Chazaras HaShatz, I don't know, you have to go out for whatever reason it is, and the person next to you, he's standing there with his feet together because he's a follower of the Rav and you can't go anywhere. So, you know, if he's a Talmud Mufak of the Rav and he weren't but with the Rav for 10 years and he does it, that's one thing. But I've been with people who they don't have this connection to the Rav, and I don't know, they think this is what they need to do, so. I don't know. Yisrael says that Rav Schechter says that many unusual practices of the Rav you'd find plain in sight of the Shulchan Aruch. Yeah, I know he says that. That's an interesting point you raise. The things I'm speaking about in the Machzor are not that. They're just talking about, he made comments about different versions, what you should say, how you should do it. That's a different question, though, that Rav Schechter is talking about. Rav Schechter says, as I've heard him myself say this, that some of these so-called unusual practices are actually found in the Shulchan Aruch or in the Nosei Keli. But that raises a different issue. Let's say for the last 400 years, no one has followed these practices. Does that mean that we're doing something wrong? Because I guarantee you, for all these practices that weren't followed, you have sources in the commentaries and others in which they explain why we don't follow that. Generally, we follow the Shulchan Aruch, but in these areas, the minhag was not to follow the Shulchan Aruch. So that's a different issue. But thank you. Who did the Rav tell these minhagim to? I don't know if the Rav ever told these minhagim to anyone. I once tried to ask his son Chaim about one of these minhagim. And I have this in print because I sent a letter, and I sent a letter with like four long questions, and Chaim sends me back a 2-line response. This is before emails. This was a letter. He says, "I do not discuss the hanhagot of my father. It goes against everything our family tradition is about." So here, I wasn't even asking him to do it. I just wanted to understand the basis of certain practices of the Rav. And if I could remember, I can't remember offhand now, what I asked him, I think one of them had to do with their understanding of Sphira, and I wanted to know what the Rav's practice was. One of the questions, if I remember correctly, I actually wanted to ask what the Rav did, but others, I just wanted to know the basis for it, and he refused to answer it to me. So, look, if you're a Talmud Mufak, you see this, you discuss it with them, maybe he told, I don't know, I mean, I know many people, Bill was in the Shir. I don't know if he ever told, if he ever explained it, or maybe he explained it, but even when he explained it, I don't think he ever said you should adopt it also. So I don't know. You, certainly people like Rav Schechter were privy to the practices, but even Rav Schechter doesn't follow, who's a Talmud Mufak, Rav Schechter doesn't follow all the practices. I don't know if, Professor Tversky did, or if Lichtenstein follows all the practices. It's a good question. Do they follow all the practices of the Rav? I don't know. Bill, who was in the shiur of the Rav, I was in the shiur, but I was only there for the summer shiur for a very short time, so I claim no judgment, no personal knowledge. Bill says that the Rav always told people to do what your parents did, that's what tradition's all about. So Bill was only there 3 years. Maybe if you were there 10 years, 15 years, then he would say you can adopt his own practices. Now, okay, let's return. So the Chasam Sofer's understanding of the proper place of Kabbalah in Jewish life has a lot to do, I think, with his opposition to the Hasidic belief in the supremacy of the Lurianic version of prayer. In fact, it's not just I think, I know. What did the Hasidim do? The Hasidim come on the scene and they institute a new siddur, a siddur which they call Nusach Sfard. It's a siddur, or you can call it Nusach Ari. It has the Lurianic Kavanot. They took things, it's an amalgamation of the Sephardic version, the Ashkenazic version, but they call it Nusach Sfard. It's amazing how many people who should know better don't know the difference between Nusach Sfard and Sephardic. In fact, in the summer tour that I had to Hungary last summer, in a few different tour guides, and these are tour guides by Jews, not ignorant Jews, one print guide and I found online, they speak about a certain synagogue as a Sephardic synagogue in Budapest. So I was doubtful because who ever heard of Sephardim in Budapest? I mean, there haven't been Sephardim in Budapest since the Muslims were driven out. But hey, you never know. Maybe a small group remained, but when I got there and I investigated and I went to the shul, it was a Chortkov shul. The Chortkov Hasidim founded it, the Nedav and Nusach Sfard. And I was at a hotel a few years ago, and they have all these Sfardim comes, so they wanted to do a nice thing. They bought all these Sephardic Pesach Machzorim. The problem was what they bought was the art scroll Nusach Sfard, as opposed to Nusach Eidot HaMizrach. But one of the, so getting back to the Hasidim, so the Hasidim instituted the Lurianic version. That was problematic for the Chasam Sofer, because why are you changing your Nusach? Why are you not doing that which the Rav Soloveitchik said, do what your parents did? Is there something wrong with the version that the Vilna Gaon used? Is there something wrong with the version of the Seder that the Ramah used, that Rashi used, that all the great sages, that now you're substituting that for a different version? Second of all, what about the disputes? You're going to put a new sitter into town? That's going to create disputes. In fact, it was this. The Chasam Sofer has a number of famous phrases, expressions that have come down to us. Chadash Sassam in the Torah, we've spoken about it. Another one of his famous quips was said with regard to this Hasidic idea that there's something better, and everyone who wants to really achieve piety should exchange their sitter for a sitter that includes the Lurianic kavanot and everything. The Chasam Sofer sees this as a methodological error, that is, this integrating Kabbalah into general practices, and also into halachic disputes, halachic discussions, because they wrote halachic tshuvot describing why you should do this, and they brought Kabbalah into their halachic discussions. The Chasam Sofer says, if you do this, you violate the prohibition against kilayim, mixed seeds. That is, you are mixing in Kabbalistic considerations into halachic arguments, and that is mixed seeds. That's kilayim. Because halacha, lachud, the Kabbalah, lachud. That is, halacha has its own methodology and its own sources, and Kabbalah has its sources, and, there are times when even a Chasam Sofer would agree if you don't have halachic sources, you could look at a Kabbalistic source. But to bring into a basic halachic argument Kabbalistic sources, he says that is kilayim. So in the face of these Kabbalistic considerations, a Chasam Sofer upholds both the validity and the equality of the Ashkenazic version of prayer. That is, those who daven Nusach Ashkenaz are in no way inferior. However, the Chasam Sofer was also aware that his teachers, both from Nassim Adler and Hafla, themselves used Lurianic Kavanot. So, in essence, they were using the Lurianic Siddur. And what's the answer? What the Chasam Sofer? What would you expect from the Chasam Sofer? For the elites, for the mystical adepts, they understand the Kavanot, they can do that. However, for every Joe Schmo, we have a principle, the Chasam Sofer believes, of Al Titosh Torah Timecha. We don't change our practices. And if it was good enough for all the great sages, then it's good enough for you. And the chutzpah, he thought, and we'll see more what he says in a minute, for the Hasidim to say that their version is superior. You're going to say that your version is superior to the Siddur used by all these great Gedolim? Fine! The Ari and Reb Nosson Adler, they saw special things in these Kavanot, so for them, there was something special about using it. But have a general rule and say that the sitter with the Kavanot is superior to the sitter used by all the Gedolim, that he couldn't accept. He himself, that is the Chasam Sofer, did not pray according to the Siddur of his teachers. He did not use the Lurianic version. He used, he prayed Ashkenazic. However, he did recite certain Lurianic Kavanot. In other words, he didn't go lock, stock, and barrel to use the Lurianic Siddur, but he did use certain Kavanot from the Lurianic Siddur. And why did he not follow his teacher in complete adoption of the Ari's version? He says he doesn't understand it. I mean, the Chasam Sofer is not understanding it. I guarantee you he understood it an enormous amount, but in his mind, he didn't feel he understood it. But since he didn't understand it, he said, he's going to do what his forefathers did and what his teachers did. He davens Nusach Ashkenaz, which we daven. However, in a few areas, I guess areas where he thought he did understand it and there was value for him, he recited the Kavanot. And he also made minor changes in the service. In line, just like I said, Rabbi Soloveitchik did, but when he davened as a chazan, he davened regular Nusach Ashkenaz. Now this does not contradict his point about that you're not supposed to mix Kabbalah and Halacha. Because remember what I said, first of all, for the elites, there you can. And second of all, and he was really referring to Halacha Pesukot, when we're dealing with Halachot, and you bring these things in. Not to mention the fact that in matters such as prayer, there always has been room for fluidity, especially on a personal basis. But always as a personal preference, not in the public sphere. That is the problem with the Hasidim. They're trying to popularize Kabbalah. They're bringing it into the public sphere. We're going to get back to this in a minute when I deal with his tshuva about the Hasidim who held that a chazan could not wear wool for Kabbalistic reasons. So we'll get back to what the Chasam Sofer says. I just want to say a few more things about the Chasam Sofer's mystical side. We saw it in the last time we met, how he had this sense that he was chosen by heaven to be the Posek Hador, so much so that even if an argument was not 100%, even if he saw that some of his arguments were not entirely compelling, that didn't change his mind that this is the proper halakha, because he is the one. He recognized that in his generation, he is the one who has been chosen to decide halakha for the nation, and therefore there is divine providence upon him. On a couple of occasions, he even offers explanations which he claims were revealed to him by heaven, which means by God. And in one place, he matter-of-factly says that I'm revealing here what God passed on to him. Now, these sorts of expressions should not be taken literally, even though the Chasam Sofer does see himself as chosen through providence to lead the nation. Don't take this literally, that it means that that when he gives you an explanation and he says this was revealed to me by heaven, that he thinks he actually had prophecy or anything like that. I mean, the Chasam Sofer himself explains the Raivad. There's a Raivad in Hilchos Lulav in the Mishnah Torah where he uses this language that was revealed to us by heaven. And the Chasam Sofer says that this doesn't mean Ruach HaKodesh or anything like that. It simply means the Spirit of God that is divine assistance of a sort on those people who study Torah Lishma. That is, that they're able, God assists them in a certain way to arrive at the truth, even if by their own intellect they would not be able to. But because of their dedication to Torah Lishma, God assists them. That is not Ruach HaKodesh. It's not a prophecy. It's not God tells them this is what it is. It's much more subtle. It's that there's a certain divine providence guiding you in the direction of the truth. And that's exactly what the Chasam Sofer felt about himself, that even though his arguments were not ironclad, that God was nevertheless directing him in a certain area. I think we can explain this as divine. This is the phrase I would coin. The Chasam Sofer was saying that Torah scholars were given divinely enhanced Torah knowledge. I think that's a good way to explain it. However, it is only among those scholars who are mystically inclined, Mekubalim, where you find these expressions. The Raivad was a great Mekubal. You find many others. Those people who use these sorts of expressions, that this was revealed to me by heaven, are the ones who are mystically inclined. So it should not surprise us in the least that the Chasam Sofer would use an expression like that, even though it does not mean actual Ruach HaKodesh, but a lesser form of divine insight, I would say. Yeah. Okay, Yisrael says that Beryl Wine was in Passaic last week and told a story how Rafaim Velezhner had a difficult shaila about Aguna and decided for the Heter and explained that he had a conversation with heaven. Okay. Well, when you hear a story like this, first of all, about Beryl Wine. Beryl Wine, many of his stories end by saying, you know, that I can't tell you that these stories happen, but I can tell you that they don't tell these stories about us. So Beryl Wine repeating a story is just a story. Now, if you show me a source, an actual source in which it says this, then we have to ask ourselves, well, what does it mean? It could mean exactly what the Chasam Sofer is saying, divinely enhanced Torah knowledge, or it could mean something else, that Chaim of Lezhner did believe that he had Ruach HaKodesh. So I can't really comment unless I see the source itself. So we'd have to get to the bottom of that. Bill asks, what was the Gaon's position on the Lurianic Sidur? It's a good question. I believe that the Gaon used the Kavanot, but I'm not 100% certain. I will check on that. I will check on that. I believe that he used, as a rule, as a standard rule, I believe that he used all the Lurianic Kavanot. I could be wrong. It could be his position was more aligned with the Chasam Sofer than only some of them. But if I'm not mistaken, he, across the board, he did. But I will get back to you on that. Thank you. He cited a source. Okay, if you can get the source from him, if you can email him. Also, remember, he was speaking, was he reading the source or was he summarizing? And it's also important to know what the source is, because if it's a source written by a follower of Reb Chaim of Lezhner, that's different than Reb Chaim of Lezhner himself saying that he had a conversation with heaven. So I'm unaware offhand of the source, so we'll need to get to the bottom of this. I mean, if you read Reb Chaim of Volozhiner's descriptions of the Vilna Gaon, he thought that the Vilna Gaon actually had real Ruach HaKodesh. Not this sort of divinely enhanced Torah knowledge, but the Vilna Gaon was at a higher level, that he actually did have it. So, it's, you know, what are we going to say about Reb Chaim? I don't know. I have to see the actual source. Shlomo says, what about Shelos HaShulis Min HaShemayim? There is an example of Ruach HaKodesh, no question about it. It's a medieval source, in which, the author of it, Rav Yaakov, has questions, and he's Ruach HaKodesh comes to him, and he answers it. Nevertheless, this is not an authoritative text. Rav Yosef, when he quotes it and he doesn't want to agree with it, he says, Lo b'shamayim hi. It's the Torah is not in heaven. But we do have a source that says that that a rabbi at Ruach HaKodesh. For the Rambam, let me say something interesting now. The Rambam's view is in line with the view in Bab Metzia that the Torah is not in heaven, and according to the Rambam, that means that we don't even care about if you come and say, this is the halacha because I have a vision from heaven, we ignore you, and that's the pshat in the Mishnah in the Gemara there. And that's, however, many Rishonim disagree with the Rambam and disagree with the Maskon of that Gemara and say that we do. Torah, yet not lo b'shamayim, but the Torah is in Shemayim, and that if a real prophet were to say that this is halacha, we do listen to it. Unlike the Rambam, who says that prophecy has no connection to decisions in Torah. And that's the view that's always quoted, but many Rishonim say otherwise. And I'm not just referring to people like Rav Yaakov, who was a Nogea B'davar, because he was the one receiving the Ruach HaKodesh and saying this is halacha. But there is a long list compiled by a great scholar in Israel, Yaakov Chaim Sofer, the great grandson of the Kafachayim, an incredible Bucky in many areas, showing that the majority view of medieval times is actually in opposition to the Rambam, and that if someone does receive a vision, that this is valid in determining the halakha. But historically, Sheol Shachus Min HaShemayim has not been, first of all, because this person is not a mainstream authority. If it was, let's say, the Ramban, or someone like that who was reporting these visions, that would be a different issue. So if Rav Yaakov was writing these tshuvot and saying they weren't from heaven, he wouldn't be any more significant than he is now because he wasn't a major authority, but it turns out that he was citing it from heaven. Look, let's not forget that the Beis Yosef has an entire book in which he describes how the Magid, this heavenly being, came to him and told him all sorts of things. But that's not used as a halachic text. Barak quotes Beryl Wine, who says that all the stories are true, only some haven't happened yet. Yes, that is true. Both of them are classic Beryl Wine lines. But the first one is actually a Musar Haskel, that they don't tell these about us. Some of these stories are repeated about the same different figures, about the same figures. I mentioned to you the famous one where it originates with Israel Hildesheimer, where someone asks him, where do you find time to learn secular studies? And he replies, when you're criticizing me, that's when I find time. The same story is repeated about Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, and it's also repeated about Rav Soloveitchik. I think it's even in a Rav Soloveitchik movie. So you find a lot of these stories. Okay, Yisrael, if you're in contact with Beryl Wine, please be in touch with him, and we can look at the source. It could be that Rav Chaim of Volozhin had a different opinion than the Chasam Sofer. Or it could be that his students, he's quoting from his students, had a different opinion. I already mentioned that Rav Chaim of Volozhin thought that the Vilna Gaon had actual Ruach HaKodesh, not the sort of divinely enhanced, what I'm calling divinely enhanced Torah knowledge that the Chasam Sofer writes about. Because the Chasam Sofer was such a believer in Kabbalah, it's very interesting to note that he did not believe that most of the Zohar is authentic. He says that if you could take the amount of the Zohar, which is actually authentic, that is actually written by Rashbi or in Tanaitic times, it would be a very small book. Most of the Zohar, according to the Chasam Sofer, is not authentic. I mean, that's exactly what he says. This is a very distressing passage for Mekubalim. However, what are you going to do? I mean, he's not denying the Zohar's authenticity. He's not certainly not denying Kabbalah. He is simply saying that the Zohar itself, and if you read the Zohar, you'd see why. The rhyme are quoted, there's all sorts of anachronisms, and he assumes that there's a kernel of authentic Zohar, and the rest, the accretions, and that's what's been, which has been added over the centuries, far outweighs, he thinks, anything which goes back to ancient days. So with that, I am going to stop for tonight. What we still need to do for the next class is his views of secular studies, and then I'm going to speak about some of his tshuvot, one or two of which deal with Hasidim, and then I'm going to tell you about some personal things, that one thing in particular, which I don't know if it's ever been quoted, and I think you'll find it eye-opening. So if we have any questions, didn't the Chassam, question is, didn't the Chassam Sofer had, have visions, about the war? Yes, he did have visions, and dreams of a sort, he did have visions, he describes it. However, he's not denying that people today can have Ruach HaKodesh, or he's simply saying though that in Torah study, when we speak about people being enlightened by God, it doesn't mean that, not to be taken literally, it means that God in a more subtle fashion is bringing them towards the truth. He is not saying that people that people could have Ruach HaKodesh in today's day and age. If I implied that, I want to take that back. That's not true. He believed that his teacher, Rav Nosson Adler, had Ruach HaKodesh. I have no doubt that when he speaks about Rav Nosson Adler, he means it literally. Yet, I think the problem might be because the halachic sphere, especially according to the Rambam, and I don't see any reason to assume he doesn't go like the Rambam in this, heavenly voices are not acceptable. So what do you do with all these passages where Rishonim say that this was shown to me by heaven? And what do you do when the Chassam Sofer uses that language? Well, the Chassam Sofer himself, he doesn't explain what he means. He explains what the Rishonim means. So obviously it means the same thing for him. He says that in those connotations, what it means is that God is allowing those who study Torah Lishma, who can't on their own get to the truth, that it's sort of like it's a joint effort between God and the person, but not that God gives a vision and says, this is the pshat in the sugya, or this is what the halacha is. No. The man who's studying comes to the conclusion through his study, but it's during the study he is helped along, as it were, through this divine guidance. But the conclusion is the conclusion of the Talmud Chacham. That's why this is important, I think, as well. Because if it's a vision, then it's not the Talmud Chacham's Torah. It's not the Talmud Chacham's Pesach. It's God telling him what it is. And the Chassam Sofer says, absolutely not. The conclusion of the Talmud Chacham is the Talmud Chacham's conclusion. The fact that God assists him, God is just assisting him in reaching a certain conclusion that on his own, although he's moving in that direction, he doesn't have enough of a push or whatever you want to call it to get there. But the conclusion is the conclusion of the Talmud Chacham. If this wasn't already a great Talmud Chacham, if the divine assistance came upon me, it wouldn't go anywhere. That is, you already have the Talmud Chacham. You need the Talmud Chacham there so that once he's given this divine assistance, then he's enabled on his own. He can then uncover the answer. But it is not God giving any answers. It's simply God helping those who help themselves or something like that. It is not a vision. It's not a prophecy. It is still the yigiyah, the striving of Torah that brings it about, as opposed to the shortcut, which is, if you remember the Gemara, the shortcut of Rabbi Eliezer, he just asks heaven, and heaven tells him what the answer is, and Rabbi Yeshua says, he jumps up and says, Lo Hashamayim. Okay, do we have any other questions? Yisrael says, the whole image of Hungarians as being the most insular and conservative Jews, any connection to the Chassam Sofer? Not really. This comes in the next generation. When we get to the Chassam Sofer, I think in 2 weeks, we will see the great machlokas between some students of the Chassam Sofer, including the Chassam Sofer's own son, and the more extreme followers, which also include the Hasidim. The Chassam Sofer was not an extremist. He was an extremist in one area when it came to reform. We will see next class his views of secular studies. We've already seen some of it. The Chassam Sofer had students who studied secular studies. So we will see that the Chassam Sofer was not an extremist at all. and the dispute and the change of direction of Hungarian Jewry happens in the next generation. In Pressburg, in the next generation, they were speaking German, they were wearing Western clothing. We will read it, we will talk about how the Ksav Sofer wants to bring Rav Israel Hildesheimer to Pressburg as the joint rabbi and to run the yeshiva of Pressburg. It will become a Torah Derech Eretz institution. And we'll see the backlash. So, although some of the extremism, if we're going to use that term, can be traced to the Chasam Sofer. For example, the Chasam Sofer is the one who says in his ethical will, you cannot preach in a language other than German, other than Yiddish. And let's remember when he said that. He said that in an era when all Orthodox Jews only spoke Yiddish. And who were the German, who wanted to preach in German? The Maskilim. And who was pushing that? The people who wanted to reform the synagogue. But when you're talking 80 years later, let's say now you're in the 1880s. Who in the 1880s is saying that the sermons still have to be in Yiddish when the entire community speaks German? Well, fine. So you have these extremists who say that we can only do it in German, in Yiddish. Are they inspired by the Chasam Sofer? Yes, because the Chasam Sofer said you can't have Yiddish sermons. However, was the Chasam Sofer talking about an era when German was the language of everyone? And if you gave it in Yiddish, no one would understand what you're talking about, and everyone would just leave the shul? That's what the Ksav Sofer is going to point out. It's as if, say, in America today, yes, the Hasidim in America today, they refuse to have English language sermons because they say the Chasam Sofer says you can't have it in any other language. Well, the Agudas Yisrael Convention was all in English. Are you going to say that the Chasam Sofer is speaking to today? So yes, the extremism of Hasidim in America that refused to have vernacular sermons, you could say, is inspired by the Chasam Sofer. But can we blame the Chasam Sofer for that sort of outlook? I don't think so. But we'll get back to that. Bill asks, was his views on the provenance of the Zohar revolutionary, unique for his time? I think it was pretty unique. The only other person to say it is Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Now, the Chasam Sofer quotes Rabbi Yaakov Emden in a different place and says that what Yaakov Emden did in the Mipachas Farim, he refers to Yaakov Emden as a Navi. He's playing on a rabbinic expression. So he thinks Rabbi Yaakov Emden, his book, Mipachas Farim, is a great text. And then the whole point of Mipachas Farim is to show that the Zohar is not, at least in large measure, authentic. But I don't know of none of the Mekubalim in the 18th century said that. I guess the question was the Chasam Sofer a Mekubal? I mean, what does it mean to be a Mekubal, a Kabbalist? If you know a lot of Kabbalah and you study it, does that make you a Kabbalist? Or do you have to be someone whose entire life is really revolves around Kabbalistic considerations? If that's what it means, then the Chasam Sofer is not a Kabbalist. Because for the most part, his life revolved around Shas and Poskim, and it didn't change his practices because of Kabbalah. But if you think that a Kabbalist is one who can achieve great insight from the Zohar and thinks the Kabbalistic texts have important things to tell us, then he was a Mekubal. If you read the debates between Alan Nadler and Sharon Flato over the Novi Yehuda, that really is what the debate is about. Sharon Flato, with a revisionist interpretation, wanting to turn the Novi Yehuda into a Mekubal, one who believes in spreading Kabbalah, and Alan Nadler saying no. The Novi Yehuda is simply one who quotes Kabbalistic texts, because after all, the Zohar is a canonical text. So fine, you're going to quote the Zohar. It doesn't make you a Kabbalist. It's a repository of wisdom. So that's the question. But it is. I have an article coming out. It should be out any day in Milan Chaviv, in the Journal of Chovei Torah. It's a Hebrew article, actually, about the Zohar. And I quote, I believe, all the sources that question the provenance and the authenticity and authority of the Zohar. And there are some that point out the Moshe Chagiz and others that certain passages in the Zohar are interpolations. But to go so far as to say that the majority of the Zohar is an interpolation, I know of no other ones in traditional society other than Yaakov Emden. Fine, you have Yehuda Aryeh Nimod in Modena in Italy, and you have others like that, but I'm talking about traditional Talmudists. Well, the article will be available online soon, so everyone will get a free copy of it that way. I'll write about it also. Okay, everyone, I'm glad to be back. Glad you're all with us, and look forward to continuing next week. with more of the hustle so far. And being that I only have four more pages of notes, I am pretty certain that next week will be the last week, and we'll probably even begin with the Ksav Sofer as well next week. And the Ksav Sofer is important, not just because of Ksav Sofer, but the creation of Hungarian Orthodoxy. The Ksav Sofer plays a central role, and there's a lot to say. Okay, so everyone, good night. Thanks again.